Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Expressing your love can look many different ways. And with the right jewelry gift from Blue Nile, it can truly sparkle. Blue Nile's collection of classic diamond jewelry makes for the kind of gift that speaks volumes without saying a single word. Or switch things up with a sapphire piece sure to spark conversation. Either way, Blue Nile's diamond guarantee ensures you get the highest quality at the best price. Express yourself with Blue Nile, the original online jeweler, at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, 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 everyone. I'm Rob Wolf, and welcome to episode number 69 of Unformatable, where we take a look at some of the less heralded Mets in our beloved franchise's quirky history. As to us, every player who dons the orange and blue is, in some way, unformatable. So we've made it to the nicest edition of the podcast, as it were. 69 is, of course, a very special number in particular for Met fans, because it marks the year of our first World Championship, of course. Now, much like the 1986 Mets, of course, it's hard to find an appropriately obscure or forgotten Miracle Met. I mean, when you've collectively sang You've Gotta Have Heart as a group for Ed Sullivan, you're all kind of immortally famous in baseball or Met fan terms. Like the 86 team for a championship star fan base, the 69 team has been lauded and feted and covered extensively. So today I thought we would look back here in Unformatable number 69 at a player who just missed taking part in that celebration and that sing-along. And rather than being a piece and a name in that New York baseball immortality, is more of a footnote to it. But an important one at that, for, as Kevin Collins himself put it, when people say I wasn't an important part of the 1969 Mets, I tell them, are you kidding? They wouldn't have gotten Don Clendenin without me. I was very important. One of four players that would get shipped to the expansion Montreal Expos for what would wind up being renowned and considered, looking back at the season when it was done, the final piece of the shocking miracle championship puzzle, the eventual 1969 World Series MVP Don Clendenin, Kevin Collins, before getting traded, virtually grew up in the Mets organization. Kevin Michael Collins was born on August 4th, 1946, in Springfield, Massachusetts. He was, with that birth date, he was generally a year ahead of his grade in school, a year young, yet he often played an age level ahead in sports. I'm constantly saying, you know, he was an athletic marvel for when I'm recounting these people's young lives. I mean, I guess it makes sense. They're all turning into professional athletes, but Kevin Collins was no exception. In high school, he was all-city in basketball. He played halfback in football, but excelled the most at baseball. He was a left-handed hitting shortstop who led his team to two Western Massachusetts championships. Not exactly a baseball hotbed. He did compete against other future major leaguers such as Mark Belanger and Fran Healy. If only it could have somehow derailed Fran Healy's future announcing career. That would have made me a much happier Met fan, at least. Collins was good enough to have colleges offering him baseball scholarships and pro teams chasing after him, in which, interestingly, and what figures into the way his career developed, I believe was the last year before the amateur draft was installed. But at any rate, at the tender age of 17, Collins decided to accept the Mets' offer of a $25,000 signing bonus to make a go of it as a major leaguer. So at age 17 in the summer of 64, Collins was off to Florida and the Rookie League, where he appeared in only 44 games, batting a modest 220, but nevertheless was added to the young Met franchise 40-man roster, joining another 64 addition to the franchise, Ron Swoboda, as well as his Rookie League roommate, Tug McGraw, as additions to the 40-man. Again, I don't entirely know the vagaries of it, but I think this was in large part due to the waiver system for young and minor league players that would wind up getting changed shortly after 64. But beyond that structure, there's also the fact that, as I think we've covered in other unformidable podcasts on mid-late 60s Mets, there was, of course, a lot of opportunity for younger players after the Mets went heavy on big, more washed-up names in the expansion draft when the franchise began in 62. Speaking of big names past their prime, Casey Stengel referred to these young Mets as the Youth of America. Between the obvious dearth of talent on the major league roster and these aforementioned older draft and waiver rules, which kind of encouraged teams to carry first-year players rather than risk losing them, the Mets' 1965 opening day roster included Kevin Collins, an 18-year-old reserve infielder, as well as Tug McGraw at the age of 20. Unlike McGraw, who did struggle mightily himself, 65, 66, 67, Collins would never really recover, I think, from the development period getting dramatically shoved forward. But before we get to that, Collins was scheduled to make his major league debut on April 25th, 1965. Casey Stengel penciled it into the lineup to start at short in the second game of a doubleheader in San Francisco, but warming up between games, he felt a pain in his shoulder that would turn out to be a tear of a lat. This would require surgery and delay his major league debut by more than 4 months. That major league debut would come on September 1st of 1965 against the Astros at Shea. Collins would pinch hit for pitcher Rob Gardner in the bottom of the third inning. The Mets were down 7-1, hence the early hook. He would strike out in his first major league at-bat, stay in the game on a double switch, and had a difficult debut, as you can imagine, for an 18-year-old in the majors. Or I guess he had probably turned 19 a little before his debut. His birthday was in August, but he went 0-for-4, striking out twice, grounding back to the pitcher, and grounding out to second. And over sporadic appearances in September of 65, he would wind up going 4-for-23, recording his first career hit with a single up the middle off of the Pirates' Bob Friend, which came on September 22nd of 1965 in his eighth major league at-bat. On October 3rd of 65, in his third career start in the, I think, next-to-last game of the season, he went 2-for-3 with a double in his third career start, a game which was most notable for Al Jackson recording his 20th loss of the season that year, which of course he pitched well in a 3-1 loss to the Phillies. But one successful game aside, he was pretty clearly overmatched, was a consensus, and even according to him himself in interviews after his career, Collins said, you know, acknowledged, "I never should have been up in the majors, probably the wrong thing for my development, but those were the rules at the time," he said, alluding to the waiver rules. And again, as I said, the amateur draft started the following year, so poor timing probably for Collins in forcing his career to start at a major league level sooner than it needed to. And he would, in fact, segue to that development phase of his career in 66. He would spend that entire season in the minor leagues. He would also miss more time, this time with a concussion when he got hit by a thrown ball in the beginning of the season. He also struggled as the organization attempted to convert him to switch hitting, tried to get him to learn to hit right-handed to improve his approve his performance against lefties, of course. By 1967, Collins was still in the minors, but, you know, again, he was a pretty well-regarded prospect. They kept him on the major league roster at the age of 18 to hold on to him, but he had been kind of passed by others in the organization, in an organization that was starting to finally churn out talent. Buddy Harrelson was settling in at shortstop as a rookie, and also in AAA with Collins were two infielders who would go on to have long major league careers, sadly not with the Mets, Sandy Alomar and Amos Otis. And I think both of them were on the rise, where Collins was not. So whereas he had mostly played short and some third, he began in AAA to transition to the utility infield role that he would be more known for as a major leaguer. In 67 in AAA, he spent his time across the infield, 40 games at shortstop, 50 at second base, 24 at third base. Got called up at the very end of September, appeared in four games, two pinch hitting appearances, and two starts at second base, going 1-for-10. At the ripe old age of 21, Collins would begin 1968 in AAA, but got recalled in, I think, May, when Bud Harrelson had to report for military duty. And he had a few memorable games. The one that I personally find most interesting, and probably was his most productive day as a major leaguer, or at least with the Mets organization, I would say, was on June 15th of 1968. Given both the productivity and the competition, Collins went 3-for-3 with three doubles against Giants ace Juan Marichal. And this was an extraordinary game that I just have to discuss a bit, just looking at the box scores, as Marichal was matched up against Tom Seaver, who shut the Giants down in the top of the first. The only base runner was on an error. And then the Mets jumped on Marichal in the bottom of the first, batted around, and again, with the inning capped with a Collins double over the center fielder's head to stake the Mets to a 3-0, stake the Mets and Seaver, of course, to a 3-0 lead at Shea. You feel pretty good about that with your ace on the hill, but of course that was a Giants team with a lot of offense, and they got to Seaver with the score 4-1 going into the top of the fifth. The Giants knocked Seaver from the game. Three straight singles with a Willie Mays single cutting the score to 4-2, and then Willie McCovey taking Seaver out to dead center in Citi Field to give the Giants and Marichal a 5-4 lead. Seaver would get relieved by Cal Kuntz, who would get out of the fifth, and the Mets would promptly tie the game off Marichal in the bottom of the fifth with two outs. Collins would get that third double and would get singled home by Tommy Agee to tie the game. I'm going to have to guess Collins got banged up scoring that run. I don't know if there was play at the plate. I couldn't find any information on it. But he scored the tying run and in the bottom of the fifth and came out of the game in the top of the sixth with Ed Charles replacing him at third base. So he was unable to continue terrorizing Juan Marichal. Marichal was nonplussed, both in giving up five runs in five innings. Didn't affect his pitching, well, or his hitting. He led off the top of the sixth. That's something you wouldn't see every day after your pitcher had given up five runs. He drew a walk and scored what would be the eventual winning run as the Giants went back ahead 6-5. Marichal would pitch around trouble from the sixth to the ninth, completing the Giants' 9-5 victory. Just your routine 16-hit complete game, as his line score in the game, 9 innings pitched, 16 hits, 5 runs, 4 earned, 1 walk, 7 strikeouts. I'm going to take a long shot and guess you're never going to see a line score like that from a major league pitcher again. Certainly not in my lifetime, or probably any of yours. I wish they had a pitch count in Baseball Reference box scores. I would love to know how many pitches it took him to complete that game. Perhaps he never would have completed it if Kevin Collins didn't have to be removed from the game. At any rate, Collins had shown enough that well, the plan was to send him back down when they got Harrelson back. Instead, pitcher and I believe past unformidable character Greg Goosen was sent down instead, and Collins stayed up at the major league level. And that would give Collins time for what would probably be the two most eventful days in his Met career in early August at the Astrodome.
Expressing your love can look many different ways, and with the right jewelry gift from Blue Nile, it can truly sparkle. Blue Nile's collection of classic diamond jewelry makes for the kind of gift that speaks volumes without saying a single word. Or switch things up with a sapphire piece sure to spark conversation. Either way, Blue Nile's diamond guarantee ensures you get the highest quality at the best price. Express yourself with Blue Nile, the original online jeweler, at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
On August 6th of 1968, in a 1-1 game in the ninth against Houston, Collins came up with two on and two out and lofted a home run down the right field line to stake the Mets to a 4-1 lead that they would hold on to in the bottom of the ninth, making his first career home run a virtual game winner and not a walk-off solely by virtue of being on the road. He actually drove in all four Met runs in that game. He got the other RBI on an RBI groundout in the seventh. The next day, Collins got a second straight start at third base, and this time it was less of a positive day for him. In the bottom of the fourth inning, with the Astros up 2-1, Doug Rader drove one to left center off of Tom Seaver, and eventually went for a triple. Rader slid into third with a hard pop-up slide, and as he came up, elbowed Collins in the jaw as he was trying to apply the tag. Collins was knocked back onto his back, dazed, possibly concussed again, and a bench-clearing brawl ensued. Collins shockingly missed only a week of play with the broken jaw. He was back on the field 6 days later, and he said he had no poor feelings about it, that it was just a hard baseball play, as I guess just about everybody said back in those days, although speculation was that that there might have been some intent, maybe not personally to Collins, but that there was a feeling that earlier in the season, Tommy Agee had injured Joe Morgan with a hard takeout slide at second base, and that there might have been some retaliation there in Raiders' slide. Much like in the Marichal game, Collins was replaced at third base by Ed Charles, and that would kind of be a theme, as Collins would be replaced by Charles, or I guess that was more of a potential platoon, but he would definitely lose any hope of a third base job to Charles and eventually Wayne Garrett in 1969. And third base was an open question for the 1969 Mets. I mean, it was basically an open question in the Mets organization most years until number five came along. But, Ed Charles was going to be at third, and Gil Hodges or a lot of platoons on that 69 team. So the team wanted someone who could platoon or split time with the veteran Charles at third. Amos Otis got the first crack, but struggled and also got on Gil Hodges' bad side. One of the rare, perhaps Gil Hodges' misjudgments, as Otis was soon out of the Mets organization and, of course, went on to a hall of very good career in, one of those, I think, underrated, horrible Mets trades. But Otis got banished quickly, so Collins got the next shot to play alongside Charles at third in April. And his first two starts, he had a couple of decent games. On April 19th, he made his first start of the 69 season against the Cardinals at Busch Stadium. Nothing not to like about a Tom Seaver-Bob Gibson matchup. And Collins went 2-for-4 off of Gibson, including a double, in a game that the Mets would win 2-1, as both pitchers would go the distance and Seaver would outduel Gibson. The next day, again against the Cardinals, Collins would hit his second and what will turn out to be his final career home run as a Met in an 11-3 Met victory in his second straight start. However, just when it looked like he might run with an opportunity, he unfortunately would go 3 for his next 28 on, which leads us to May 4th, 1969. Collins went 0 for 2 in a start that he had, dropping his average on the season to 150. In his second at-bat at that game, he struck out looking against Bill Hands. The Mets held a tight 3-2 lead later in the game, so Charles came in and pinch hit for Collins. And little did he know, he had that strikeout looking would wind up being his final at-bat as a Met. Seaver would go the distance again. The 69 Mets would increase their record to 10-14. People probably thought they were a cute little team that maybe could make a run at 500 that year. But Collins, the next day, would be sent down to AAA as Wayne Garrett would get called up and, of course, would wind up taking that opportunity and running with it at 69 and sharing the job with Ed Charles. Obviously, it was just emotion, and you know, it wasn't like he was traded yet, but I think in a lovely show of, you know, the kind of person it seems like Collins was, he left notes for Ken Boswell, who was his roommate, and also a note for Art Chamsky, who inherited his locker and basically like his utility infield job, encouraging them, you know, and wishing them well. Collins probably thought and hoped he'd be back up in that locker room with the Mets. But a month later, on June 15th, with that earlier trade deadline, the surprising young Mets were 30-26, 9 games behind the Chicago Cubs, who were astounding 41-19 at that point, but obviously competitive and growing, and the team decided to bring in a veteran first baseman and a power-hitting bat to supplement their offense and help out their incredibly talented young pitching staff. And so it was Collins, along with Steve Renko, Jake Harden, and David Colon, who would go to the Expos for Don Clendenin. Renko is an interesting story, too, and I was looking at both of them for this podcast, and I think he's someone I'll probably discuss sometime soon as well. He had an interesting career, although he never played for the Mets in the majors. But Renko is probably the most productive player the Expos acquired in that trade, although Collins did go up to the majors with them and spend the 69 season with them. Collins took on that utility role that the Mets once prepared him for with the Expos, and spent the 69 season with them. He said he learned a lot from Expos manager Gene Mauch, and he did, as a little footnote for the Expos franchise, and I only refer to them as the Expos franchise, I refuse to think of other spots they've been in. He hit the Expos' first ever pinch-hit home run off of Jim Bunning on July 17th of 1969. Collins spent 70 in the minors for Montreal until the Expos sold his contract to the Detroit Tigers late in the 1970 season. Collins had sporadic playing time for the Tigers in 70 and 71, spending most of those seasons in AAA as well, getting in 60 games across the two seasons. And again, in the obvious caveat of the short sample size, perhaps having his most productive little spurt in 71 in 41 at-bats. He hit .268, slugged .438, had a 707 OPS, which was the highest line that he had by a long shot in any season of his career. Again, small little seasons. The most at-bats he had in a single year were 154 with the 68 Mets. Although one other nice and interesting anecdote about Collins that I read in a great Sabre article about him that helped with this is one of the more notable things about his career in 71 that made the media and the sporting news was that when he was with the Tigers, he roomed with outfielder Gates Brown, which, you know, in that 1970-71 era was a rare pairing of white and black players as roommates, but which Collins, to his credit, thought it was not a notable thing. Collins stayed in the Tigers organization in 72-73 and never got above AAA Toledo. Got traded to the Indians organization, where he spent 73 and 74 in AAA. When at the age of 27, he decided to hang it up, essentially saying in an interview he had had enough. He did not want to be Crash Davis. Although, no disrespect to Collins, but I don't think he was going to set a minor league home run record either. But I get the sentiment. The Indians offered Collins an opportunity to stay in the organization as a coach or as a scout, but he just decided to retire from baseball entirely in 1974. He and his family moved to Michigan, where he took a job with an auto supply store owned or run by a former Tigers teammate, and he lived most of his life in Michigan before moving down to Florida, where he passed away on February 20th of 2016 in Naples, Florida. Over parts of six major league seasons, Collins had 388 major league at-bats. He hit six home runs, went 81 for 388, six homers, 34 RBIs, 30 runs scored, one stolen base, a 245 209 batting average, 209 batting average, 245 on base, 320 slugging for a 565 OPS, 62 OPS plus, and a negative 9 WAR, according to Baseball Reference. As a very young Met over four parts of four seasons, he was in 89 games, two homers, I think I kind of covered them both, 15 RBIs, 42 for 227, a 185, 221, 269, 490 slash line. Perhaps he got cheated a bit by the way the development of his career was kind of forced and thrust upon him by baseball's rules at the time, and having started in the majors at such a young age, but certainly not something that he ever seemed to let bother him personally. And in addition to a couple of memorable Met moments, he was a key piece in one of the more memorable and most positive trades in Mets history that brought the team Don Clendenin and eventually helped the team bring the 1969 World Championship to New York. Thank you for taking the time to listen to Unformettable. Please go to AmazingAvenue.com for more Mets-related content. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and you can find this and all of our amazing pods wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe to them if possible. Leave us a review. It helps us out. Original music by Bunga. I'm on Twitter at WolfRR, WOLFFRR, and the show is at Unformettable. Thank you, and as always, let's go, Mets.